Welcome to episode 307 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today we're covering three countries. In France, we'll find out about Saint-Foy-Tarentaise, which I had a fantastic trip to last week. We'll hear about a ski safari across the Dolomites in Italy, and we'll go on a ski touring adventure in Austria. We also have our regular snow reports from across the Alps, your feedback, and that is today's show. Now, before we meet today's guests, I'd like to thank Tirol Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast this winter. Since the autumn, we have covered 10 great destinations in the Tirol. I won't list them all here, but they include some you will definitely have heard of, like Kitzbühel, Meierhofen, and St. Anton, and some that may have slipped past your radar, such as Tirol West, Surfhaus, or San Johann. I've certainly enjoyed finding out more about an area I love, and you can too, as all those episodes are in our back catalogue to catch up with. Let's move on to today's show and meet our guest today. The wonderful Irish lilt of our first guest will be very familiar to regular listeners. She's been on the show many times before and was indeed our expert for our Innsbruck episode of our Tirol cast. Welcome back to Ireland's leading ski specialist, Catherine Murphy. Hi, Catherine. How are you?
Hi, Ian, I'm good. In stormy Dublin today, a little bit stormy here.
Okay, well, we have a bit of a wind here in Brighton where I'm based. I will actually just turn to my second guest today then. He will also be familiar to regular listeners. He was last on the show sharing his knowledge of Tirol when he told us about Surfhaus Fisladis in episode 291. He joins us today for his second appearance on the podcast. Welcome back to freelance journalist Simon Miller. Hi, Simon, how are you?
Really well. Great to be back. Thank you, Ian. I'm looking forward to talking about Corinthian skiing.
Excellent. And Catherine's in Dublin. Whereabouts are you today?
I am in London and looking forward to the storm that's in Ireland heading our way, I think.
Right. Well, regular listeners will know the way I like to start off the podcast is to find out from, I guess, when you skied or snowboarded last. Catherine, you spend a lot of time out in the Alps. I'm guessing you've probably just come back from a trip. Where were you skiing last?
Well, I was last skiing at the end of February in Deer Valley in Utah, actually. We went over to have a look at the new expanded terrain.
Right. Okay. Now, if I think carefully, I'm going to say that we had Emily Summers from Deer Valley on the podcast. Pretty amazing expansion of the terrain there. What did you think of it? If you can give me not a full report, but a little summary.
Well, they've more or less doubled the size of the terrain, haven't they? And so we skied over, well, what we skied was kind of cruisy blue and red slopes. Not all of the terrain is open yet. And when you ski down to the what's going to be the new East Village, it's still a construction site. One of the new hotels is opened, but they're still building and will be for some time to come. But really interesting, yeah, and some really nice terrain.
Right, okay. And Simon, let's turn to you. When were you last on snow?
I was skiing at the back end of January. I was in the Three Valleys, specifically in Brie-les-Bains, down at the bottom there, and then spent a few days also in Saint-Martin-de-Belleville. So enjoyed perhaps the sort of the lesser known villages that are all part of the Three Valleys.
That's interesting because I was in Brie-les-Bains, staying there for the first time in February. And you know, evidently there's a payoff. I discussed this in the last episode. It's a lot less expensive than staying anywhere else in the Three Valleys, but it takes you half an hour each way on the lift. How did you find that trade-off?
I mean, you spotted it in one. I mean, the trade-off is there. I think it's great. I mean, you know, the atmosphere down in Brie-les-Bains was really sort of cozy. I think the people who were there enjoyed it. There was some, you know, nice bars and restaurants. So I think you do get the atmosphere there. I think that if you're disciplined, and I think that a lot of people who go there are very keen skiers. So they're happy to get that sort of early lift and they effectively arrive at the sort of the hub of the skiing in Méribel Village at about the same time as everybody else. But they're sort of willing to get up that sort of 25 minutes, half an hour earlier. So it serves a purpose. It's a really good option for those who are sort of wanting to have a slightly less expensive way of enjoying, you know, a gigantic ski area.
Yeah, I mean, I covered this in the last episode, but I went to go and visit my kids who are both doing ski seasons in the Three Valleys. And it just happened to be at the start of vacances scolaires. And literally, it was £500 a night for a room in a hotel in Méribel or £130 down in Brie-les-Bains. And so for my budget, that was like a no-brainer.
Absolutely. And I think that for, you know, I think there's a mixture of sort of young families for whom it makes a lot of sense. I also noticed, you know, again, this is not scientific. It's not a sort of, I wasn't doing a 1,000 person survey to make sure I got absolutely sort of perfect data. But there were a lot of people who were, shall we say, at the upper end of their skiing age bracket, who didn't want to sort of, you know, indulge in the all-night party atmosphere and yet still have a sort of a reasonable night out. So I think that it sort of suits those two sort of demographics as well. If you're on a budget, whatever age, then it's the right place to be.
Well, I hope you're not trying to say that I'm falling into that age category as well, Simon. Right. Okay. Well, we do have snow reports from some of our regular contributors from around the mountains. Let's hear from them now. Bethany Garner is reporting from Saint-Gervais. Jen Sang from Laplan. Dave Burrows was in Lellecrozay, which you'll have to check the show notes to see the spelling of that, in the Jura Mountains. And Floss Cockle from the YouTube channel Free Flow Floss reports from Team.
Hi Ian, it's Bethany, phoning in a snow report from Saint-Gervais in the Mont Blanc Valley. So I skied in Saint-Gervais on Sunday and today. Conditions are typically spring, so hard packed in the morning, and in the afternoon getting slushy from kind of lunchtime onwards. Very typical spring conditions, but I've got to say, after the February snow, the huge amounts of snow we had here, the resort's doing really, really well on the coverage. And some of the south orientated slopes get a bit more slushy than others, and there are a few bare patches here and there. But honestly, high up, coverage is fantastic, all the pieces are skiing well. And the good news is that from Saturday, it looks like there's going to be some fresh snow, and maybe even a sprinkling before that. So I think anyone heading out next week should have slightly fresher snow, slightly cooler temperatures, still probably spring conditions, but we've been really, really lucky with the volume of snow, which is going to probably see us out to the end of the season. So yeah, that's the snow report from Saint-Gervais. Yeah, I hope that helps everyone who are planning their last minute trips, or anyone that's got holiday and is getting excited to heading out. Have a great time. Thanks. Bye.
Hi, Ian and the Ski Podcast. Welcome to the slopes of Laplan. This is Jen from That's Laplan, and I'm coming to you live from the slopes of Laplan to tell you all about the snow conditions. So come ski down the Pollux Run into Plan Centre with me as I tell you what it's like. So last week we had the Sirocco effect, which, if you've been watching all the different ski resorts, is the Saharan sand getting blown over here, and it created a really opalescent milky sky and orange snow where the sand fell last week. It was very warm conditions in resort as well. It felt very, very spring-like. Fortunately, the huge amount of snow that we had at the start of Feb really has put us in good stead, and we've still got over, I think it's 2 meters, 85 centimeters of snow up at the glacier level, and like 150 or something at 2000 meters here in Laplan. So it really is great on the slopes. It has cooled down this week. We are looking at quite overcast skies at the moment. We were forecast some snow last night. We had a tiny little fluttering, but nothing else to really report about here. The temperature did drop a little, but it was very wet, and definitely in the lower levels, I would say from like 1500 and lower, it was definitely snowing rather than it was, definitely raining, sorry, rather than it was snowing. But like I said, the piece still holding up really nicely. And of course it is March, which means it's a lot quieter in resort than it was in February, so we're very happy about that as well. Looking forward, we're looking at very kind of consistent weather patterns, so similar wind direction, similar temperatures. The avalanche risk is currently 2 out of 5 in the resort, so again, looking very stable. And we are just looking forward to some real spring conditions. So we're thinking long lunches on the terrace, the obvious clock change, giving us longer days on the slopes, and we're really moving into that spring pattern, and then Easter skiing in April. So this has been pretty much it from me. Take care, and perhaps I will see you on the slopes of the plan sometime soon. Bye-bye now.
Hello Ian, it's Dave from Snow Pros Ski School. I hope you and your listeners are well. Today you find me in a resort called Lellecrozay. Be careful about the pronunciations here, because there's lots of silent X's and silent Z's. Anyway, I'm here with my good friends Husey and Toby. These guys have come out because we've done, on Saturday we did a big charity day for the charity that we have. We had about 50 kids who were affected by cancer skiing with us, so we've had a great day with that. That all went off very successfully, but your listeners probably don't want to know about that. What they want to know is what the snow is like. So you don't just get my opinion on this, you get the boys. So they've been skiing for the last 3 or 4 days. We've been skiing in the Port du Soleil, and today here in the first resort that you can possibly ski once you land in Geneva. So what's the snow been like, fellas?
It's early doors only. It's not afternoon skiing. It gets slushy and sticky post 2 o'clock.
So I think what he's saying there is that in the morning, so it's kind of spring skiing at the moment. So we've got spring skiing. It's kind of firm in the morning. There's an absolute golden time around, what, 10? Yeah, 11-ish. It's glorious. And then after lunch, have your big lunch and then just ski home, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, Tobe? What's it been like?
Yeah, it's been good. I really like the portage today. Definitely gets a bit slushy in the afternoon. But nice to see someone new today over in Jura. First two runs have been fast. Enjoying it.
What we're doing today is we're having a ski here. So we've kind of driven back towards the airport, but these guys don't actually take off till tomorrow. So we're having a ski here. This place has been on my bucket list for years and I've never been here. And I'm glad I've come because it's actually really good. This is proper little best kept secret of skiing near Geneva, really. Yeah, and there's no one here, is there? It's absolutely glorious March skiing. And one other little thing that you probably need to know is that what normally happens when we have this kind of hot spell that we've had, so we had masses and masses of snow at half term. The hot spell that we had, that we're having now, and we've had for kind of like 2 weeks almost now, hasn't come with the hot wind. So it's hot, but it hasn't had the foam wind attached to it, which means that the snow hasn't been eaten by the wind. So it's pretty good. Snow coverage is amazing for like mid-March. Anyway, there you go, Ian. Hope you and the listeners are well, and I will see you at some point in the future. See you later. Bye.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski, bringing you the snow report from the Tarentaise Valley. Now, it has been very hot conditions lately. I would actually say that March has been record April hot temperatures. So we're in spring conditions with great conditions on the piste. We've got nice and hard pack first thing, and then a melt freeze and slightly slushy in the afternoons. But if you continue skiing on the North Face slopes, especially at mid altitude over 2000 meters, the condition in the snow is great. With the last recent snowfall of 2.5 meters a couple of weeks ago, we actually got a snowpack above average, above 2,000 metres, and it's slightly below average, below 2,000 metres. And looking into this week, a few days of sunshine, still warm temperatures, and a nice melt freeze at 1,800 metres, but we've got a good front coming in, a high weather front coming into Friday, and we're anticipating up to 60 centimetres of snow this Saturday. Now, for the off-piste avalanche, level at the moment has dramatically dropped from a 4.5 consistently for 7 days in a row now. It has been 2 out of 5, which is amazing. However, because of the setup and the persistent weak layers in the snowpack, it's still very dangerous at high altitude and wind-loaded slopes. So just be careful out there. Have a great week. Enjoy your skiing.
Right, let's look at some news. The Paralympics are underway in Italy. Team GB won 6 medals in Beijing in 2022 and have a modest target of 2 to 4 medals for these games. Earlier this week, Neil Simpson picked up Team GB's first medal with silver in the men's visually impaired combined. Also in racing news, I was delighted to see that Zach Carrick-Smith made his World Cup debut in slalom in Kranjska-Gora. I am sure most of our listeners will know the Ski Podcast sponsors Team Carrick-Smith. So it's fantastic to see that now all three of the Carrick-Smith brothers have raced in World Cup this season. And bear in mind that Zach and Freddie are only 19. Luca is only 20. They are consistently the youngest on the start list. So it's great news for the future of British ski racing. Now, we're going to turn to Sainte-Foy in France. If you don't know this resort, its full name is Sainte-Foy-Tarentaise, and there's a clue in the name. It's in the Tarentaise Valley in France. I travelled out there by train to Bourg-Saint-Maurice, and from there it's just 25 minutes up to the resort. My guess is many of our listeners will have noticed it as they've driven past on their way to Tignes and Val d'Isère. When you drive, you actually pass through the village as opposed to the station, the ski resort area. You have to turn left slightly higher up to go to the main resort where most of the accommodation and the lifts are. And I can't tell you how impressed I was with Sainte-Foy. Up until last week, it was the only resort in the Tarentaise I'd never skied in. And to be honest with you, I only skied one piste because I was out there to write an article about backcountry skiing for Full Line magazine. But I could see straight away why so many people go there year after year. Sainte-Foy only opened as a ski resort in 1990, and there are actually only 4 lifts there. But it really ticks boxes for families, advanced skiers alike. And the British chalet company Premier Neige is a Sainte-Foy specialist. They started there shortly after the resort opened. So I was really interested to speak with founder Fiona Harvey-Jordan about how she saw that gap in the market.
I'm really pleased to be joined by Fiona Harvey-Jordan, the founder of Premier Neige. And thank you so much for letting me stay in your beautiful chalet here. It really is a fantastic resort. I'm really fascinated to find out a little bit more about the company. I think that you were doing ski seasons in Val d'Isère before you ever came to Saint-Foix.
Yes, I was. I was up. First season was with Le Ski, and then I got a bit hooked on ski seasons and decided to do another season with VIP. And by then I was getting good enough that I was allowed to come down to Saint-Foix. It was where all the ski instructors would go as a little hidden gem on their day off to ski all this perfect powder with no one else. So it was absolutely a magical place then. Only three lifts and one or two restaurants and a few ski bums staying in camper vans.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I mean, I had heard about it. I was doing ski seasons in the mid-90s as well. And Saint-Foix would often get mentioned. And in fact, it's quite an omission from my skiing CV. This is the first time I've ever come here. So many years.
Well, I'm glad you finally made it.
When you went down from Val d'Isère to Saint-Foix, you must have seen something in it there. Evidently, all these instructors, you know, really enjoyed it. But I believe it was a little bit later where you saw the opportunity to start a chalet company and a tour operator based here.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. So I'd done three seasons, and after that I thought, I have to grow up now and get a real job and go back to Edinburgh. So I was working for an events company, but I was really always trying to find a way to get back to the Alps. And one day I saw MGM, the big developer, and they had this amazing project for Saint-Foix. Saw the chalets and apartments, and just something clicked. I thought, right, this is my moment. It's now or never. So that was where the seed started. And within 6 months, I think I'd packed up and we were in a Land Rover on our way to Saint-Foix.
That's amazing. I mean, it's a big jump to me from seeing there's a bunch of apartments available for sale and then actually setting up, you know, a company where you're inviting guests to come. Was contracting a little difficult, or was it straightforward trying to find properties that you'd be able to rent out?
Yeah, it was more actually persuading my parents and friends that I hadn't totally lost the plot, really. But actually, lots of people there in Saint-Foix were intrigued and very kind to let us take on their chalets and try something at the beginning. It was a very undeveloped place with not many properties available. So it was quite a new thing for a jeune fille écossaise to come along and try this. So, yeah, we had a really good welcome. So one chalet was a local French lady. Another was a client from when I was up in Val d'Isère, was VIP. And actually now he's my husband. So I guess it worked out well.
And so you found properties, but, you know, now you're the dominant tour operator in your own office here. I'm staying in your flagship property. Yeah. How did you build that portfolio of properties from where you started?
We actually started thinking that we'd be a very much off-piste, gnarly ski operation. And our original clients were, we would take them on ski safaris. So they'd stay in a catered chalet with us. And then every day we'd take them out to a different resort because Val d'Isère, Tiene, Les Arcs and La Rosière are all within 20 minutes drive. But people skied in Saint-Foix and very quickly they were like, we don't want to go anywhere else. This is absolutely amazing. Well-groomed piece, empty, amazing ski touring. The off-piste was beautiful. And also the restaurants, they're all run by passionate local people who'd been there for years, cooking local food. There was no sort of pretense. And so I think people really enjoyed that mountain experience with fantastic skiing. So we quickly pivoted because people would come on holiday, actually fall in love and buy a property because the properties weren't too expensive at that stage, because they wanted to bring their families and wives and friends to come and share it. And in Saint-Foix, kids ski for free under 8. So it's a brilliant place to come and learn as a family. So I think we had to go from being gnarly off-piste to suddenly we built a creche, we had nannies, we did all these things so people actually could go out and ski and still have their family holiday they always wanted.
Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right there. While I've had a fantastic backcountry adventure over the last couple of days, it's evident to me that this is a great resort for families. Out the front, literally off my balcony now, the lifts have closed and the kids are doing tobogganing, you know, with their parents. The resort only has 4 lifts, But there's a lot of skiing. Yeah. Having talked to a lot of people while I've been here, there's also a lack of skiers around. So you don't really have any queues and you've got plenty of space on the slopes as well. I did contrast it slightly with when I was in Mirabel a few weeks ago. And admittedly, the upper lists were closed because it was bad weather. But that, I could not believe how busy the slopes were. And then in addition to that, you've got all of this access to off-piste from the lifts, let alone having to go into the backcountry. So I can see how it grew. And talking to the tourist office, they told me that at one point, up to 60% of the visitors to St. Foix were from Britain.
So I think you've hit it beautifully about the skiing. Is a lot of clients have called it millionaire skiing. So they feel like they own the resort. It doesn't matter. We can be completely full with all our 25 chalets. People go, where is everybody? And it's somehow the mountain seems to swallow people up. So when you go at the marquees, it's a beautiful wide blue piste and you can actually have the place to yourself. Then you pop into one of the local restaurants. There'll be people there enjoying a nice beer or apres-ski or some lovely lunch. And then you can go off skiing again. And again, you suddenly find you have the slopes to yourselves. So it is a magical touch that St. Foix has, that it seems to swallow up the skiers either on-piste and off-piste. And I think it is that mixture of being able to pop off-piste, do some ski touring, and then pop back on the piste and meet up with your family. That is something very special in St. Foix, that you don't have to get a bus or go a different area like someone like Chamonix, where you completely separate areas. In St. Foix, the off-piste, the beginner, and the sort of intermediate can all meet up very easily.
Yeah, and I might add, it's only a 25-minute transfer from Bourg-Saint-Marie. So, you know, I came by train, not very long at all. But I think, evidently, it's a great resort for all different abilities of skiers. And you have a lot of chalets here, and you brought a lot of people here. But people don't just come because it's a good resort. There must be something about the way that you've run Premier Neige over the years, because actually in the chalet where I am at the moment, there are some guests who've been with you since you first started. The other guests who are staying are a family who've been coming for 10 years. Do you think, I don't know if there's a question you can answer, but do you think there's a reason, you know, why would you think that you've done? I know the resort is great, but there must be something about the way that you've managed things that's drawn people back.
I think it's the people. We're very lucky that we've had a lot of our staff have worked for us now for 15 years. Carlotta, who you've met, a lovely chalet manager in the Peak. She's on her third season. And I think it's a mixture of we really care. And I know that sounds a bit cheesy, but we really do want people to have an absolutely fantastic holiday. We also are passionate about St. Foix itself. And we just want to share that magic with people. But also, I think it is something that's quite unique that we really go the extra mile. And I think you've probably seen in the Peak, the rooms are bigger than you'd probably see in most traditional chalets. Everything's slightly better because St. Foix is maybe smaller. We don't have cinemas and caviar and designer shops. So I think we really want to make sure that everything that we have control of is the best it can possibly be. So guests have no reason not to come back.
As far as I can see, everything you said there seems to stack up. I mean, the service here has been absolutely fantastic. And I've stayed in quite a lot of chalets and worked for chalet companies over my long ski career. And I know chalets have improved since, you know, you and I were working back in the 90s.
Yes.
But they are fantastic here. Evidently, Fiona, you're obviously doing many of the right things and people keep coming back. So what I can say to you is, well, congratulations for picking out St. Foix as you did, you know, many years ago. And I'll certainly be recommending it. A couple of your guests have said, no, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone about it. unfortunately, that's the case. So that's brilliant, Fiona. Thanks so much for sharing all of that. And I look forward to coming back to St. Foix again.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I think that sense of community in St. Foix really comes through. My guide for the backcountry adventure was Nicholas Burrell. He was one of the first three ESF instructors when the resort opened. And in fact, his grandparents owned the original building in St. Foix, the Maison des Colonnes. That's now a restaurant. And in fact, that architectural style, the columns, colonne, has been preserved across St. Foix. You see it everywhere, including all the new developments. Now, just opposite, the Maison des Colonnes is a small bar called Llama Llama. And I spoke to the owner, Rachel, about the sense of community in St. Foix.
Great. So I'm here with Rachel Pilkington, as the owner of Llama Llama here in St. Foix. I wonder if we could just start by maybe explain what Llama Llama is.
So it's a small bar on the snow front of St. Foix, offering, we do English breakfast, lunches, and then drinks through the evening as well. for everyone, really, for families, old, young, but
yeah,
everybody.
Because your location, you're right next to the ESF here and near to the Luge, but evidently you've got a nice little group of people enjoying their après-ski here.
Yeah, the seasonaires are all in, our local seasonaires, all friends are in.
Right, now, and that's interesting to me, because you said that you've been here for around 8 years, and you're talking about the community, there's a strong community sense in San Juan.
There is a really strong community. It's a small place, so it's very easy to get to know people quickly. And so even seasonaires coming in year after year, on their first year, they're welcome in quite quickly to the seasonaires that come back year after year. So it's got a huge sense of community, I think.
And you've been here for 8 years. You've been running Llama Llama for three. But in those 8 years, do you think you've seen much of a change in San Juan? Obviously, quite a few big things have happened in that period of time.
Yeah, we've definitely seen a change. Clientele has changed, obviously, after Brexit and then through COVID. There was a change in the clientele that were coming. Obviously, there's been building work going on in the resort to make it slightly larger, which has obviously had a change to the aesthetic. Although it's nice that the commune keep everything traditional.
Yeah.
So everything looks traditional. There's not the big stone breeze block apartments. It's a beautiful resort.
Yeah. Well, we're sitting almost opposite the Maison de Colón,
yes,
the original building here in San Juan. And you see that architecture reflected in so many of the different buildings here.
Yeah.
So I like the way it's been retained.
Yeah.
But what I've experienced in the 48 hours or so that I've been here is that a lot of people come back again and again.
Yeah, there is a huge returning client. We see the same clients year after year and in the summer as well. So a lot of people will come the same time, multiple times through the winter, and then again in the summer. It's a big return, yeah.
Cool.
And anybody that finds it definitely comes back.
Yeah, well, I can see there's people coming back right now. There's a queue building up at the bar. So I'm not gonna hold you back any more, Rachel. Thanks for that insight into San Juan.
I haven't really touched on the backcountry side of things. Look, I only skied one run on the piece, and I spent 2 days ski touring, being guided around backcountry by Nico. The last snowfall had been 10 days beforehand, but he kept finding us unskied light powder on north-facing slopes. And there is simply a massive wild domain to explore there. I'm not going to go into it all now, but you'll have to check my article for Full Line magazine in the autumn for more on that story. Let's turn to Italy now. I went to the Dolomites last year for the first time, and I definitely want to return. Such a beautiful area. But Catherine, you tried a different way of discovering the region rather than just being based in a single resort. I wondered if you could just tell us what that trip was.
Yeah, so early January, I did a full week ski safari, all on piste, with a company called Inspired Italy. It's a company that's run from, well, Lou Anderton and Tim Hudson from York in England, and their partner Matteo Baffi, who's Italian, obviously. And they run about five or six different ski safari itineraries through the Dolomites. And I've been to the Dolomites before, Ian, many times, but after doing this ski safari, covering something like 400 kilometres of slopes over the week, I feel like I've really done the Dolomites. You really get to know the whole ski area very well.
That's amazing. 400 kilometres is a lot. I mean, I guess a number of our listeners will have been to the Dolomites and will have done the Sella Ronda. So it was a circuit, wasn't it? Because I did look it up. I think he told me the name of the particular tour that you did is Specialismo,
yeah.
If I pronounce that correct. So you started in Ortisai and finished in Ortisai, but you cover a lot of ground in between.
Exactly, yeah. So we were travelling north to south through the centre of the Dolomites. And the first couple of nights, we stayed in a beautiful family-run hotel called the Mia Via Slow Farm Hotel, just above Ortisai, a little village called Bulla, I think. So we spent the first day kind of having a ski day, warm-up, skiing Selva Val Gardena. And then we basically travelled through Passo San Pellegrino, not where the water's made, onto Civetta, Alta Badia, called Fosco, Marmolada, Lagazoi, and then we ended up back in Ortisai for a last night in that hotel. So you're basically skiing from refuge to refuge. You're staying in mountain huts for four nights out of the seven nights.
It sounds like a great adventure, but there's a couple of questions. So I stayed in a refuge when I was in San Juan, And my refuge was a dorm of 17 people with no shower and no hot water. I'm pretty sure these kind of refuges are a bit different from that, right?
Yeah, there's a real mix. I think the cost of the refuges we were staying in are, some of them are more like Shelley's, to be honest. The cost is anywhere from between 150 euros a night to 650 euros a night. Our last refuge stay, was the price range. I think the most traditional of the refuges we stayed in is the Lagazoi, which is a beautifully maintained, preserved Shelley. The others were more, yeah, they're more modernised and beautiful, all beautiful places. We were sharing rooms, so there were three women on our tour, I think, and three men. So the women were sharing and obviously the men were sharing. But we weren't in 17-person dorms, no, not quite.
And you had, you know, proper beds and things as opposed to just like a duvet and a blanket or something.
No, proper. No bunk beds, no steep ladders up into the top bunk, Ian, or anything like that. No, lovely, really lovely bedrooms, very well appointed, great food, obviously. But I think the whole trip for me was just a week of experiences, people, places. I think 60% of Inspired Italy's guests are from America and they get 33% repeat custom. And also Tim was our ski leader for the week. And just the amount of knowledge he has. I mean, it's such a huge area, the Dolomiti Super Ski, isn't it? It's 1,200 kilometres, not all linked by lift, but a vast area. So his local knowledge, the relationships with the people that they work with in the resorts is amazing. So, you know, they get on really well with everyone. And just a week filled with experiences, insider tips on everything, restaurants to eat in, and obviously, yeah, amazing experience.
Well, that doesn't surprise me to hear that Tim, you know, has a huge amount of knowledge. You know, regular listeners will have heard him giving his snow reports from the Dolomites on the podcast. You mentioned that 60% of the clientele are from the States. I think I'm right in saying that the Dolomiti Super Ski is on the Icon Pass. Do you think that's a factor within that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, first of all, American people just love, well, the Dolomites are just absolutely stunningly beautiful, aren't they, and unique. So American visitors want to go there. But yeah, and I think Inspired Italy guests get a discount if they're Icon Pass holders. I've noticed that on the website during the week. So, and just to veer away from skiing just for a moment, both Tim and Louise were highly involved in hang gliding. Going back to the 90s, Louise is a former world champion hang gliding pilot. Tim was involved in running competitions, and they really bring that experience into how they operate briefings and how they run their ski safaris. Everything is extremely well organized. Very nice company to travel with.
Well, I wonder if you could just explain a little bit more. If you're going from hut to hut and you're doing a safari, are you carrying everything with you?
They have a kind of a ski lightly ethos. So your main luggage stays back at the hotel where you end up back in at the end of the safari. We were given 20 litre backpacks, basically, and they showed us everything. They gave us tips on how to pack it efficiently and how to use it getting on and off lifts, you know, kind of pulling it around to the front and stuff. Yeah, just travelled for those four nights in the refuges with a couple of pairs of leggings for nighttime, maybe a fleece top. And you don't want to carry too much. You don't want to be weighed down with a heavy backpack. So it was perfect. You just travel lightly. And I just think we were talking about experiences there, Ian, and just obviously when you're staying in the refuges, you're getting first tracks every morning. We were leaving refuges at 10 past 8, 20 past 8 in the morning. So four mornings of first tracks, which is pretty special. And skiing down through the Hidden Valley from the refuge Lagazoi, you know, pretty amazing experiences. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly my experience of refuges and the example from last week when I was in San Foix, the real joy is getting up in the morning, walking outside the refuge, and there's no one around at all. You've got the whole mountain to yourself, and it's just so quiet. That's what I really like about it. Just such a beautiful time to be in the mountains.
Yeah. It's the silence. And I mean, around that area of the Dolomites as well, there's a lot of World War history. There's a lot of, you know, in the Sud Tyrol, so you've got the whole Ladin culture and language. So it's a very rich experience, not to mention the food. Ian, dare I say I was eating pasta twice a day. That's all I can say. We had fantastic.
You're burning off a lot of energy. So you're covering a lot of ground there. I think you said over 400 kilometers. Who's it suitable for in terms of skiers? Do you need to be an advanced or expert skier? Is it more broadly open?
So the one we did, the safari we did, was easy to moderate, but you have to be a confident skier on red runs. They say you may do a black here and there, but you may not. Tim would really stress that it's about pace and fitness. So we're skiing on beautifully groomed slopes throughout the whole week. But you've got to be able to ski if it's snowing. You don't have the option of saying, I don't want to ski this afternoon. You're skiing onto the next refuge, so you've got to keep going. You've got to be able to ski whatever the conditions are. So it's about pace and fitness and just being a confident red run skier. We ski the Marmalade Glacier 3 times, which is moderately difficult, I guess. Fantastic 12-kilometre run down to the valley. So, yeah, you want to be a good enough skier, confident skier to ski the Marmalade Glacier.
Had you been to the Dolomites before, Catherine?
Yeah, I've done the Sella Ronda multiple times and skied, yeah, stayed in different villages around the Sella Ronda. So, yeah, definitely I've been there. I've been there summer and winter.
So how did you think this way of seeing the Dolomites compared to, let's say, basing yourself in a single resort?
Just fantastic, and a completely different experience because you're staying up on the mountain and staying in the refuge. Is totally different experience. And I feel I really got to know the Dolomites a lot better this time. And I also got to travel through places, to ski through places that I wouldn't otherwise have gone to. So like San Pellegrino, Civetta, Val di Zoldo, beautiful wild area, lovely kind of rural family ski areas. Just absolutely magical, I have to say. For me, very special trip.
Oh, well, it sounds fantastic. You know, I had never been to the Dolomites until last winter, when I ended up going twice. And I certainly will be going back again, because as you said, it's such a beautiful area. And maybe this is a different way of going about it. So when I plan in, I should get in contact with Tim, and I'll put a link to Inspired Italy in the show notes. That's great, Catherine. If it's okay with you, then I'm going to turn to Simon now for our third country in this episode. Now, there are some similarities, I think, between Catherine's experience being on a ski safari, my experience in Sainte-Foy, where I was ski touring. But I think your recent visit to Austria was different from both of those.
Yeah, so I went to Carinthia, which is in the southeastern part of Austria. I actually flew to Graz and then got the new fast train to Klagenfurt, and then a transfer up to Katschberg. The tour itself was ski touring, so skinning up and skiing down. And the idea was to traverse terrain, so ski from resort to resort to resort. And each of the resorts was effectively a sort of small, really beautiful family resort. But the idea is to connect those on a thing called the Nockberger Trail.
I'm glad you said that for me, because I wasn't entirely sure how to pronounce that. So the Nockberger Trail in Carinthia, Austria. And that's interesting. Just tell me a little bit about that new fast train that you mentioned from Graz. What is that?
Golly, I think it's, golly, you're testing me here. I think it's about 40 minutes, 45 minutes. It's a new train. I think they've basically plowed through a tunnel, which has shortened the journey time. And I think it's, I'm right in saying it's been open for about 6 months, maybe a year. So really quite new, and is a great gateway to that part of Austria. And I think British Airways have got new flights to Graz as well. And whilst it's not great skiing in the town of Graz, Graz itself is a beautiful city. So also a nice side journey for anybody wanting to ski in that part of the world.
Now, you've already written an article about this, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. But I read it before we came together today. And you described it as ski touring as if it was designed by people who dream up aromatherapy marketing material. I wondered what you meant by that.
Well, I was listening carefully to what Catherine was saying, and the idea of staying in huts, ski touring, I've done a lot of that, and it's great, but the idea of sharing a hut with, you know, some, you know, snoring middle-aged men, of which potentially I am one of them, did not appeal. And so this tour, organized by a company called Trail Angels, has varying levels, so 3, 4, and I think even 5-star, and you can pick the hotel level that you want to stay in. But the crucial thing is, you always come back down to valley level and stay in a nice hotel, and you know, with all of the comforts that go with that. You can either do this sort of lightweight and essentially just sort of carry a day pack plus stuff for a hotel, but also there is an option for luggage transfer. So, you know, if you want to sort of dress up in all of your finery each evening, your luggage can be transferred around each day, and you can go and spoil yourself to your heart's delight.
So if you're going for that five-star option, and as you say, you want to dress in your finery, you're saying that your bags will be transferred on by Trail Angels, the organiser, from one hotel to the next every day.
Exactly right. And they do a great job. They organise everything from the guide. They also make sure that you've got single-use lift passes. It's not a resort holiday. It's very much a touring holiday. But because it goes from resort to resort, you end up sort of often at the end of the day, maybe skiing back down through the resort. And certainly at the beginning of the day, if there is a lift to use, their philosophy is you may as well use it. It's only when there are no lifts that you put your skins on and do the work yourself. And so you're often buying, as I say, single-use lift passes to make life a little bit easier.
In that respect, it does sound a bit like the ski safari that Catherine went on. But as opposed to Catherine's trip, you are ski touring. It's not an insubstantial amount of climbing that you're doing on a daily basis.
That's right. I mean, I think it varies, obviously, with conditions and weather and so on. I think on one day we did about 1,000 vertical meters, which took, God, I can't remember now, about 6-7 hours in all. I mean, that includes a lunch stop and the skiing down. I think on average, you sort of reckon on about 350 meters per hour ski touring. Obviously, it depends upon the terrain and your fitness and conditions and so on. But that gives you a sense of the number of hours that you're skinning uphill. That's part of the enjoyment. I think, you know, if you're ski touring in this way, the beauty is getting that remoteness, getting away from everything. And certainly you're getting to areas which you can't get to without skins on. And that's the real joy. That's the real thrill.
I think, you know, the points that you make there are lots of the reasons that people like ski touring. You know, I like it because you can get away. You can reach those areas where there aren't any lifts. But it sounds like, you know, you can tell me if you think this is right. This is maybe, you know, ski touring for the ski touring curious. Yeah, a gateway into ski touring that is maybe not as, you know, hardcore as some of the other images we might think of.
I think that's a good way of describing it. I think I'd describe it sort of ski touring for softies. And you know, because you've got your guide or you're with a group, you can set the level. The idea that this is some sort of machismo way to access, you know, incredible steep descents, that's not what this is about. It's about being in this, it goes through a natural sort of natural park, which is protected. You're in this just incredible mountain scenery for hour after hour after hour, but all in a sort of confined and safe space, and the luxury of an evening where you've really, really earned that beer in front of the fire. And you can look in comfort around the hotel bar and say, well, you guys have been skiing on piste and using chairlifts all day. And inside your head, you're sitting there smugly saying, I've done, you know, a few hundred vertical meters of climbing all day. Maybe that's just me though.
No, I like that side of things. I think another element of these type of trips, what Catherine experienced and what you experienced, and to a certain degree my ski touring in St. Foy as well, is I think it gives you as the skier a much better understanding of the geography and the communities around skiing, because you're joining up all the links between the ski resorts. People will go to a ski resort and go to another ski resort, but they don't often understand how closely they are linked to each other via a couple of passes or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. And that becomes perhaps particularly evident when you see some of the signs along the way, because in summer, this is great walking terrain. So, you know, self-evidently, and perhaps it's an obvious point to make, but a lot of these places in Austria are huge summer walking trails, which in some instances go back, you know, to the tax collectors from hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So there have been people living in these places for a very long time. It's often the, unfortunate to say, the tax collectors who set up these sort of walking trails. You're often walking along paths or skiing down trails that have been there for a very long time. And you do get a sense of that history in the community when you do these trips.
And just remind the listeners, so the Nockberger Trail that you went on, how many days was that?
It's variable. So there are about, you know, between 3 and 5, but you can make it longer or shorter, obviously. You start off in a place typically called Katschberg, which is a lovely small resort in Carinthia. We then skied through Innerkrems, onto then Tour Achahua, where I happened to bump into Franz Klammer in Tour Achahua, which was great fun, completely randomly. Then we moved on to the Falkirksee and then ended up in Bad Kleinkirchheim. So, but you don't necessarily need to do all of those stops on the Nockberger Trail. When you go to the website, you can see the options to say, hey, I want to do a 3-day or a 5-day trip, and the various different hotel levels that you want to book in for.
It sounds great. I have to congratulate you or comment on your pronunciation, Simon. Are you a natural German speaker, or have you just been practicing those?
I have spent a lot of time in Austria. So, I've picked up a reasonable, a passing ability to sort of speak moderately good German.
And Catherine, you were nodding along there. Have you skied out in Carinthia or possibly bumped into Franz Klammer out there as well?
Yeah, absolutely. God, it must be over 20 years ago we did a trip, and we actually spent a few days. Franz was an ambassador for the region. So we spent a few days skiing with Franz. We had amazing, amazing fun and a few late nights.
And I can say, Catherine, he remembers you.
Excellent. That's brilliant, Simon. Thank you so much for that. It sounds really interesting. And I think, in today's episode, we've covered, quite a lot of ground there, three different countries, three different trips. But I think that point that I was making there about how all these different resorts and how all these regions, link together, hopefully, listener, we've given you a sense for that and maybe, given you some inspiration for your next trip. So, Simon and Catherine, that's great. We're just going to move towards a close now. If you've enjoyed this episode, or even if you didn't like it, I would love to know. You can leave a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @SkiPodcast, or you can drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. We have had a bit of feedback since the last episode. Paul Bond said, the Winter Olympic podcasts were great. Games were fantastic. It was great stuff from Team GB with much future promise. And Poppy Porteous said, I want to be an Olympic champion. And I love listening to your podcast. So best of luck with that, Poppy. And Nicholas said, I loved your recent episode about cat skiing in Georgia. Brought back some great memories of recent cat skiing adventures. There are now 307 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. 183 of those were listened to in the last week. If you'd like to get some insight into a particular destination, listen to an interview with an athlete, or find out about the latest kit, just go to skipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you are bound to find something of interest to listen to. In the last week, people have been listening to podcasts across the planet. The majority of our listeners are in the UK, 29% were in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Mexico, Thailand, and South Africa. If you would like to help the podcast this week, I have just one request. If you don't already, I would really appreciate it if you subscribe. Just pause now, go to your podcatcher of choice, click that button. Thank you very much. Don't forget, you can save yourself some money on ski hire if you use code SKIPODCAST when you book at intersportrent.com. Finally, regular listeners might recall that as of tomorrow, I am relocating to Chamonix, one of my favourite places, for a couple of months. Don't worry, though, I will still be recording while I'm there, with plenty of adventures lined up to report on. The podcast will be back again for episode 308 in 2 weeks' time, when we'll be discussing mountain refuges across the world and the ski resort of Sundance in Utah, made famous by Robert Redford. So until then, I'd like to thank my guest today. Catherine, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ian.
And Simon, thank you.
You're welcome.
I would like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast. And fine listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.